Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Nearly half of Utah's wilderness programs for troubled teens closed in the last year. Here's what's happening. Alta Ski Area shuns a proposed gondola and says metering signals could be the answer to Little Cottonwood Canyon traffic. And where are Utah's most endangered historic buildings and places? Those are the headlines for today. Joining me are Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Miller. Jessica, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Olympics and Enterprise reporter Julie Jagg is with us. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Real estate reporter Tony Semerad joins us.
Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday. Thank you. And news columnist Robert Gerke is with us. Thank you.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Jessica, let's start with you. Wilderness programs for troubled teens, I think we've been aware of these, especially on those occasions when, when teens have died. It happened in the 90s and the 2000s. I don't know that we've had a death since then in Utah.
Not in wilderness programs, in residential treatment programs, more in buildings. There have been a couple in the last couple of years, but not kids that are hiking in the desert.
Now, in other states, I think back east somewhere, there was a death earlier this year.
Yes, there was a death just a couple of months ago in North Carolina.
Yeah. If we have time, I hope we do. We'll get into, you have a kind of a side story on how Utah became the center place for these wilderness programs. But the headline here is nearly half of Utah's wilderness programs for troubled teens closed in the last year. Do we know why that's happening?
Yeah, so four programs in the last year have closed, which means there's only five left, which feels like kind of a small number, but Utah averages around 11 programs a year, and each of these programs can take about 100 kids at a time. So that really is a really big hit to the industry. And so when I noticed that a lot of these programs were closing, kind of one after the other, I started trying to talk with people in the industry and ask them what was going on. And the common themes that I've heard is there is a lot of negative attention surrounding this industry, and it's the pressure's really being put on right now by former residents who are, posting TikTok videos and going on Instagram, and they have Netflix shows and they're in media news reports, and they're telling a lot of negative stories about their experiences in these programs. That's been really hard for the industry to combat, paired with some of these programs are funded by private equity or larger corporations, and those corporations are just completely pulling out of the industry and putting their investments in other areas of healthcare.
Are these programs licensed by the state or some other government?
Yes, yeah, they're licensed by Utah, and they're actually have a lot of regulations. And this came in response to some of those deaths that you mentioned in the 90s and early 2000s. They're regulated down to how heavy a kid's backpack can be, how much water they're supposed to have. The temperature, if it gets above, I think it's 90 degrees, they're not allowed to go hiking. So it is pretty regulated. Obviously, the licensors go in and they find problems. There was one program in the last year or so that had ill equipment and kids were getting frostbite. So it's not perfect, but there are a lot of regulations in place that are supposed to be keeping these kids safe.
I want to change my mind. I want to bring in your other story here, because I think it's very relevant. You went back and did some history. There's a gentleman called Larry Dean Olson, a BYU professor, I think, who I guess started taking young people out into the wilderness, and it's discovering that once they had done that, they behaved a little better. So, tell me a little bit about this.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so this is kind of the start of the wilderness therapy industry, at least in the Western U.S. There was, at the time he was a student, but Larry Dean Olson started as a student with doing these after-school survivalist programs, teaching skills that he learned just as a kid growing up in Idaho, I guess. And these BYU deans noticed that the students that were doing the after-school program were improving, they were doing great, they were really interested. And so Larry Dean Olson eventually became a professor. They developed this course. They essentially took a bunch of flunking BYU students, put them in this program for a couple of weeks, and found that their scores were improving and that they ended up, finishing school. And so that was kind of the first time we've seen the wilderness used as a mechanism to try to improve student behavior.
Then later on, people like Steve Cardassano came in and I guess added, layered on top of this, a kind of a boot camp approach.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, Larry Dean Olson really kind of preached like the healing properties of nature and wasn't really so like punitive, did not like those methods. He went off and started his own program and charged maybe like a couple hundred bucks or whatever for the program. So where Steve Cardassano and some of these other people were different was not only were they, you know, very militaristic, they're marching kids through the desert, they're yelling in their faces, that kind of stuff. They also jacked up the prices. So now they're charging, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for a very similar program. So what Steve Cardassano really figured out is that you can make a ton of money off of programs like this.
Larry Dean Olson, at some point, he repudiated this new approach, right? He didn't like the boot camp approach.
Yeah, exactly. When I was doing my research, I found a couple of points where he had publicly spoken about not liking that militaristic turn that this idea that he created had sparked into. And that is kind of more, I mean, that the militaristic approach or kind of, you know, everyone does the same thing, that did carry for a long time. That kind of became the norm in the industry for quite some time.
There's another piece of this that I guess I hadn't been aware of. At a certain point, I don't know if it's actually part of the program, but parents start hiring people to come and they take your teenager from their bedroom and you know, transport them under force to these programs.
Yeah, it's a very, very common way, not just in wilderness programs, but any like troubled teen or youth treatment program. For a very long time, that was the way that programs told parents they had to get their kids to the program. So you'd essentially pay a couple thousand dollars, parents would. They would come into a kid's bedroom in the middle of the night. There's no explanation to this kid of what's happening. These strangers would just take them out of their bed and then transport them to the program. But this part of the industry is completely unregulated. So they can, you know, they can handcuff them, they can hold them down, they can do essentially anything that they want to get this kid to the program. And it's all paid for by the parents, and the kids at the time have no idea what's happening. And I've talked with a lot of people who've had that experience, and a lot of them say that that's the most traumatic part of, you know, being part of this program or, you know, entering the troubled teen industry, was you start off your quote unquote treatment with this intense trauma. You think you're getting kidnapped.
So this became a pretty big industry, and very much in Utah, other states as well, but very much in Utah as well. What has happened in, I guess, more recent years? Has it declined, been declining?
At least, so this story focused on the wilderness therapy aspect of it. I'm not sure about other teen treatment centers, but for the wilderness therapy, at least, yes, we've seen, as you mentioned before, programs are closing. But then I looked at inspection reports of the programs that are open, and it appears that they are operating like at a fraction of what they could be. They have the capacity to have 86 students. And when an inspector went in, there's 6 students there. So even those that are open seem like the numbers are much, much lower than normal. And so, yeah, the industry is really struggling now in a way that it hasn't, as you mentioned, since a lot of these deaths and a lot of attention was put on the industry back in the 90s and the early 2000s.
One thing I learned from your story is I think we tend to forget the wilderness therapy programs tend to get the headlines. There are a bunch of inpatient, programs, and I guess you can get government payment for insurance pays for these, I guess, more readily than the wilderness, and that becomes a cheaper option for parents.
Yeah, so there is a growth of, they call them like 30-day stabilization units. So it's more short term. And ideally, it's like in the community where these young people live. So they're not being sent across the country or being sent to Utah. And so we're seeing some, as I mentioned, like large healthcare corporations, they're taking their investments out of wilderness therapy. They're closing those programs and they're moving that instead to these 30-day stabilization programs because it's seen as a better option. I mean, from what I've talked with experts, like parents don't love the idea of like their kids being out in the wilderness, and they read these stories about these deaths and the whole transport issue, as we talked about, like parents are starting to get a little bit uneasy. They have a lot more information. And so these kind of short-term stabilization programs that's often covered by insurance seems like a much more attractive option. And so these larger corporations or private equity is kind of running to that as maybe where healthcare for teens with mental health struggles is going to go from here.
You mentioned the story, Paris Hilton. Was, I guess as a teen, she was in one of these inpatient programs in Utah. And she, because she's pointing out problems as she sees it at the facility she was in.
Yeah, I think that that was one, as I talked with some of the activists who were former residents or former, you know, had gone through these programs, they, a lot of them pinpoint this point in 2020 when Paris Hilton started speaking out. She had a documentary where she talked about her time at Provo Canyon School and how abusive she says that it was there. And she has really become an activist, kind of unexpectedly, I would say, to try to bring more regulation to this industry. She helped pass a law in Utah. She's done it in a couple more other states. She's working on federal regulation. And so people who went through these programs saw her story and also saw her being listened to, that people were taking her seriously. And that kind of motivated them to say, oh, okay, well, I can share my story too. I, like, people will believe me. Because for a long time, people didn't believe these kids when they would say, I was kidnapped in the middle of the night. Like, it sounds so dramatic. And they're like, quote unquote, like troubled. They've got that label as a troubled teen. They really weren't believed. But now people are listening. And, you know, I think society has a better understanding of mental health and what's treatment and what's not. And so she's really helped spark the conversation over what appropriate treatment should be for teenagers.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation, there is a trade group, Outdoor Behavioral Healthcare Council. What are they saying?
They told me that a lot of this negative attention is really, really hard to combat. And they believe that one side of the story is being pulled. You know, there's a lot of laws related around HIPAA. So they feel like if a student comes out and says, this is my terrible experience, they can't really come back and like rebut that they can't share a lot of information about like that particular student. But they also feel like a lot of stories of good outcomes aren't being shared, or families go online and say, you know, this helped my kid, that sometimes people will go and like attack them online. And so they feel like their perspective isn't being heard. And there's just so much negative attention that it's hard for business right now.
Were you able to talk to any of the, I guess, the owners, operators of wilderness therapy programs?
I tried really hard, and it was very difficult. No, I mean, I reached out to every owner of a closed program in Utah. I've reached out to every owner of an active program in Utah. I could not get anyone to speak with me on the record. There was one person who owns, I think, Second Nature Wilderness, who sent me a statement that kind of echoed the same things that we just talked about, that the Outdoor Behavioral Wilderness or Healthcare Wilderness Council, OBH Council, had said. So no, it was very, very difficult to get people in the industry to speak publicly about what's happening right now in their industry.
Yeah. Understandable. In the meantime, at least one of the people who are, you know, putting these videos out on TikTok, expressed to you that they're hopeful that, this results in no outdoor wilderness therapy programs.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of momentum right now, and they, and these activists are really hoping that they can keep riding this momentum and maybe cause other programs to close. That's their ultimate goal.
Well, Jessica Miller, investigative reporter, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Robert Gerke, what do you think about this story?
Well, I think it's not a surprising trend necessarily. I think, like Jessica said, it's, there's been a lot of negative publicity on these programs. And if you're a parent who's looking for someplace to put your kid, it's really hard to know for sure that the program that you're looking at is legit, that they're going to be safe there. And so I think it sows that seed in the doubt, seed of doubt in the parents' brains. And they're, you know, they don't want to put their kid in a shady program. And so I think what it's going to ultimately do is force these programs to be a lot more transparent, find a way that they can, you know, erase that doubt, and so parents can know that they're, that their kids are safe. And so it's going to lead to a whole change of the model if the model wants to survive. And I think The other thing that maybe we need to keep an eye on too is oftentimes, as we've seen in the past, that you mentioned Steve Cardozano, when there is heat turned up in one area, they move to another area. And I don't know, Jessica, if that's something that we've seen as well. But I think it's probably something to keep an eye on too, if these programs are just leaving here and going somewhere else, or if they're actually, a reduction in options. But ultimately, at the end of the day, hopefully, it leads to a more transparent, more accountable, and better program, if they're going to survive. Because there is some benefit to these outward bound type programs that for kids, and so there are probably some therapeutic benefits. But again, the problem has been some bad actors in the field have kind of made it a lot more difficult for that to be an option.
Well, let's head toward a break here. When we come back, we'll be talking about Alta Ski Area shunning a proposed gondola. They say metering signals could be the answer to Little Cottonwood Canyon traffic. We'll be talking with Olympics and Enterprise reporter Julie Jagg. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Alta Ski Area shuns a proposed gondola and says metering signals could be the answer to Little Cottonwood Canyon traffic. We bring in Olympics and Enterprise reporter Julie Jagg. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Before we jump into this one, tragic news from just yesterday. Two skiers died in an avalanche up Little Cottonwood Canyon. I think this was yesterday, right? Tell me just a little bit about this.
Right, yeah. Really tragic story. So two or three backcountry skiers were doing what I'm told is a very strenuous, difficult route up to toward Lone Peak Summit. And that's kind of between, it's basically due south of Bells Canyon Waterfall and in Little Cottonwood Canyon. And they were making this hike up and had just switched into their from hiking to their gear to skin up, basically. And then they were near the top and it triggered an avalanche, and that swept up all three of them, and one survived and the other two did not.
I understand from your story that apparently they had all the right gear. I guess just a reminder that you never do know.
Right. Yeah. The names have not been released yet. And the recovery process of the two that died is going on this morning. But from what we understand from the rescuers are up there, and maybe some people knew them, but it sounds like they're very experienced and yeah, very, very knowledgeable. And in fact, the one survivor apparently was able to actually find the other two, but just couldn't save them in time.
Yeah. Our prayers go to the families and, of course, the surviving gentleman. Thanks for covering that story. Let's turn to the traffic in Little Cottonwood Canyon. There's, of course, the Utah Department of Transportation, I think, is, I don't know, the middle, is that's probably not the right word, but proceeding with possible plans to try to relieve traffic. Now the news is the general manager of Alta Ski Area, Mike Mon, issued a letter that he's calling the Red Snake Letter. What's Red Snake a reference to?
Right. Yeah. So Red Snake is a pretty common term among skiers and snowboarders for the, probably others, but for the long line of traffic up and down the canyon. So when all the brake lights are on, as you're heading down or as you're heading up, that's considered the Red Snake.
So among the measures proposed to reduce this traffic congestion is a gondola. Is that still on track?
Yep, that's still on track. Could be, I think they're talking about 2043 was the last I saw that would be the earliest that it could happen. There's no funding yet for it, per se, but directly for it anyway. But yeah, so it's a ways out. But so the for this there's three phases of the of UDOT's plan, and the first phase involves tolling, and then they'll move on to keep that in, I think, and then add additional buses, and then the third phase is the gondola.
So, Mike Mon, Altus Gary, and I think Altus Town Council signed onto this letter. What are they saying? What are they proposing?
Yeah, so his point, and this is something that they had done a study, and the study, to study the traffic problems, because it seems to be, he thinks they're skiers and that are the ones that are taking the brunt of this red snake. And basically, I've seen horror stories on social media of people getting stuck in their parking lot for hours, where they're ready to go at 3 o'clock, and yet they can't move until 5 or later. And so he commissioned a study, and the study basically told him that for every two ski Alta skiers that are going down, so between every two cars coming down from Alta, at minimum 5 cars from Snowbird would fill in between. And if he says that if the cars are directed onto the bypass road, which they often are if there's particularly snowy conditions, or especially if there's avalanche danger at all, because that direct mo the most direct route up to 10 to between Snowbird and Alta is right in a couple of avalanche paths. So if they're directed into this bypass route, that hits more exits from the out from the Snowbird ski area. And so he says up to 500 cars from Snowbird could fit in between 2 cars from Alta.
Yeah, I hadn't quite understood the geography here until I read your story. Of course, I'm not from that area. I don't ski there. Altus at the top, Snowbird is near the top, I guess. So, if you go to Alta, you're all the way up top of the canyon, and coming down Snowbird, I guess drivers would have kind of first crack at it.
Exactly. Yep. They have the first stop on the way up, and then they have the first exit on the way down. So he was concerned that that snowbird skiers and snowboarders are, getting all of them are leaving, and then by the time the Alta skiers can finally get out of the parking lot, then they're, driving past these completely empty resort at Snowbird. So his proposal was that he didn't think that tolling and buses and even the gondola were going to fix that, because he thinks people are just going to keep coming up no matter what the toll is. They'll just, maybe carpool more, but it'll be more people still coming up and the same number of people going down. So he wanted to suggest a few alternatives, I guess, that he felt like UDOT had not explored.
I guess one idea would be to get a sticker verifying you have the right tires and tread.
Yeah, and that program is already exists. You can do that now, but in that story we did previously with I did previously with Andy Larson, we found out basically that that sticker is to for people to check themselves, right? To make sure, just basically take you into a tire shop and make sure you have good enough tread to be going up there, and make sure you have the right traction devices. But he's hoping that, and this is something that also Dave Fields from Snowbird is behind, is that UDOT would use those stickers a little more forcefully and only allow cars that have those stickers into the canyon whenever there's even a threat of a fairly big snowstorm.
Field says, I'll quote this from your story. He says, "I'd like to say that the highway only works as well as the worst car driver on it." So I guess he's in favor of getting unprepared cars and drivers off that road.
Yeah, that's one of the adjustments that both of those managers of both those resorts agreed upon, is that they both would like to see more enforcement of the traction laws. And yeah, the problem I think that they both find is that cars that can go up when it's nice, because there's no traction law in effect, don't necessarily make it down very well. And also same with people who are not used to driving in the snow. It's a lot. Even if you have the right tires, if you aren't sure how to drive in the snow, it's not the best thing to do on a steep, windy canyon.
Right. I guess one problem that some people see is cars parking on the side of the road and then making U-turns.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that was definitely something that Mon took issue with. And I think it is a problem, but there it also provides more parking, which resorts seem to not have enough of. But maybe if there's less parking, more people would use the buses. So it's hard to say. But Snowbird is cutting down on their parking on the north side of the road, but the parking on the south side, which would be, you know, the side you're on as you're driving up the canyon, is still going to remain. And when those cars want to go home, usually the best way to do it for them is to just flip around.
There seems to be a little bit of a tension between Snowbird and Alta, right? Snowbird, according to your story, says that they see some problems with Alta's Sunnyside at 3 program. What? Tell me about that.
Right. So that's a program just to encourage, basically, I think it's meant to encourage people with children or new skiers to come up and ski the resort. So it's a very discounted pass, but you can only use it for an hour and a half, and you can only use it on one lift, which is the Sunnyside lift, which accesses mostly green, kind of easier green and blue runs. So he's saying, hey, you're packing up, you know, I complain about all the cars coming down, but you're packing them in late in the afternoon. I don't know how many people actually take advantage of that Sunnyside at 3 program to make that big of a difference, but it is something that Alta offers, and it does draw people up later, which then causes them to, you know, leave later.
And I guess, I don't know, probably both resorts are hopeful to, you know, you always want more skiers to come, right? But there might be just a total capacity, and the bottleneck might be the road. Are they worried about that?
Yeah, Mike Mon was interested. That was an interesting point that he made, is that he told me he did not want, they weren't looking to grow Alta's skiers that much more. They said they were pretty comfortable with the number that they've been getting, and they're not looking to bring in a lot more skiers. It's not what this initiative is all about, that they basically just want to make it more convenient for their skiers to get in and get out when they want to.
Oh, interesting. In the meantime, UDOT, I think, is just proceeding with their plans. What's up next on their plan?
Yeah, so they said that they're you know, pretty much sticking to their plan, and they'll explore other options, but they've kind of made their decisions. And yeah, so I believe tolling is I don't want to venture a guess because I don't actually know for sure, but within the next year, I believe tolling is supposed to begin in the canyon, and then also UTA is working with a third party to ramp up its bus services. So we'll see some changes in that regard within the next couple of years.
All right, Julie Jagg, thanks for telling us about this.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Gerke, what do you think about this one?
Yeah, I mean, this sounds to me like it's a pretty big setback for the gondola, because you have this very costly project that's supposed to benefit two resorts, and one of them, you know, doesn't really want it, or one of the town doesn't want it. And so, you know, you've got a, obviously people at the bottom are opposing it, Salt Lake County, Sandy, you know, and so you've got to ask, you know, what the benefit of it is here. And I think, as Julie noted, this tolling discussion has been going on for years now. And until that's in place, it's hard to know if that's going to alleviate some of the congestion. So I think it's, you know, we're going to wait and see, I guess, what the impact of that is. And you know, the gondola's planning is proceeding in the meantime. But, you know, is it something that even the parties that it's supposed to benefit want? It sounds like the answer to that is, well, in some cases, no. And so, you know, it probably is hopefully going to give planners a little bit of pause before they go charging down that path. And so, you know, it's a work in progress, and we'll, I'm sure Julie will keep us up to date on how it's proceeding. And you know, if Alta can have its concerns addressed, then maybe there's a future for it. But in the meantime, again, tolling seems to be a good option, and the bus increased bus service. You know, maybe there are other ways to address this issue of congestion in the canyons.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following a break, we'll talk with real estate reporter Tony Semerad, and we'll talk about Utah's most endangered historic buildings and places. More following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We're bringing now real estate reporter Tony Semerad. Tony, thanks.
Hey, you bet. Thanks for having me.
So you have a story, kind of a rundown of some of Utah's most endangered historic buildings and places. We talked a few weeks ago about the Fifth Ward, where the owner, unauthorized, went in and started tearing that down. And an alert city employee noticed that and stopped it. But so that brought some attention to Fifth Ward. Of course, the Bravado Hall in Japantown, also on this list, are front and center because of the new sports district for the Utah Jazz and the new hockey team. Maybe let's start there. You'd start that way in the story. Bravado Hall in Japantown. Tell me a little bit about this.
Yeah, well, we're coming into this discussion with heightened attention to historic sites, I think, from the Fifth Ward meeting house, which you mentioned. And yes, indeed, the proposal for a sort of transformational entertainment district in the downtown area has brought a number of sites kind of into play. Abravanel, of course, has surfaced part of this discussion, and the debate has even gone to major renovations and or demolition of Abravanel Hall, maybe moving it as part of kind of figuring out where we locate a new NHL stadium and support blocks kind of around it. And there has been an immense outpouring on behalf of Abravanel Hall. I looked this morning in the change.org petition to preserve and save it is above 25,000 signatures. And I don't think that's been online for more than a week. Caught up on in this is what's now sort of a remnant stretch on 100 South, kind of right there by the Salt Palace, which is all that is left of Japantown, which thrived as an Asian American community there in the downtown area, spanned a number of blocks from the 1800s forward as immigrant families poured into the area back then. There's essentially just, with the renovation or with the construction of the Salt Palace in the 60s, pretty much all of that was seized by eminent domain and demolished to make way for this new convention facility as part of a big urban renewal, quote unquote, movement around the country. All that's left there now, there's a Buddhist temple, a Japanese church, and a sort of a pocket park, a beautiful Asian pocket park kind of right next to the Salt Palace. And interestingly, there have been longstanding plans forged by the Asian American community to renovate that stretch of Japantown and make it more sort of a cultural hub reflective of its history. Those have been in the works for a number of years. And now with this discussion of an entertainment district, there seems to be quite a bit of momentum towards maybe a more radical restoration of Japantown in some ways. That's become part of the mix about the entertainment district. And, kind of into this whole mix, Preservation Utah, the nonprofit that devotes itself to awareness and preservation of these sites, has issued a list of a number of other endangered buildings and places, not only in Salt Lake County, but kind of around the state, mostly to kind of raise awareness, but also this is Preservation Month in May, and Preservation Utah is interested in building this list and is accepting suggestions from residents statewide as to other sites that should be preserved, and is really calling on the public. Preservation Utah is to speak up for these community treasures, these landmarks that are in jeopardy, and it's only really through the public's involvement in neighborhoods and communities around these sites that that awareness of preservation is going to be elevated. So yeah, they issued a list of about 17 sites in five counties. A lot of these have been in the news over recent years. But the idea is, once these landmarks are gone, they're never coming back. And so they're urging the public to pitch in.
We won't have time to mention all of them, of course, but they did on the list is Salt Lake City's West Side. I guess the entire West Side.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting in inclusion. Essentially, they're making the case that the East Side neighborhoods of Salt Lake City over the years have afforded themselves of residents there of the ability to create historic districts, which do provide some protections for contributing structures in the districts. The West Side has not availed itself of that, and there have been some interesting legal reasons, from the state legislature for that. And Preservation Utah is making the case that neighborhoods like Rose Park and Fair Park and Glendale and Poplar Grove and West Point are really historic treasures of their own. They have very diverse and eclectic mix of housing, mix of buildings. And they're making the case that this area deserves a sort of unique respect, given that it was, for many decades and generations, the only place that lower income residents and people of color could find a place to live. And so they're urging stepped up protections for those neighborhoods.
And the sites don't include just Salt Lake City. So homes and buildings in Summit County, a lot of those historic A-frames, I guess, are gone, for one thing. Logan's Main Street was mentioned. St. George, I guess, downtown. I wonder if have you mentioned San Juan County had a particular location on the list.
A fascinating, it's called the Olejato Trading Post on the western edge of Olejato Monument Valley in Utah, south of Bluff. It's founded in 1906, a fascinating little location that, like a lot of these landmarks, has faced years of disuse and deterioration. And in this particular case, there's a pretty vibrant sort of sub-community down there that's working on fundraising for it, so yeah, Preservation Utah highlighted that in San Juan County.
Tony Simmerit, thank you so much for telling us about this.
You bet. Thank you.
Robert Gerke, what are your thoughts on this? And then maybe give me the short version of your story out of Bravenel Hall.
Sure. I think this is important that people are at least highlighting these because, there's been this big push to build more, build more, build more in Salt Lake City and the surrounding areas to address the housing shortage we have. But we risk losing these places that make Salt Lake City special and in the process. And so, does it have any tangible effect? Perhaps it doesn't, but it also at least highlights the importance of preserving some of these places and preserving the character of the city. Tony mentioned Japantown, and that's a good segue into what you asked me about with the Robinel, because I was at a meeting last night with 80 Japanese descendants who were concerned about the future of Japantown, Mayor Mendenhall was there and made assurances that they're going to maintain the or improve, I guess she said, the integrity or the area. She's requested $400,000 for a cityscape improvement there. And it dovetails with this issue with Abravanel Hall. I mean, Salt Lake County has this long list of improvements that are going to be needed, things like HVAC repairs that are tens of millions of dollars, $80 million is what I was told. And so the question now has become, are they going to renovate Abravanel Hall, or are they going to rebuild Abravanel Hall? And if so, what does that look like? I mean, that is still in motion, I guess, as part of this sports entertainment culture convention district that it comes with the hockey team. Again, it raises the questions of what is the future of Japantown. And there's also a proposal that I was covering, be posting a story this morning about they want to remove all the height restrictions on the buildings in that 7-block area around the Delta Center, including the Salt Palace Convention Center. So you could see these enormous skyscrapers popping up around there, conceivably. I mean, it's not like there's not a plan in place for that yet, but that's what they're proposing. So it's bringing huge changes, and going back to what Tony's story was talking about, with these huge changes, we've got to it's important to maintain some sort of semblance of the character of the city that made it unique. So it's a balancing act that the cities, well, cities all over the state are constantly trying to deal with.
Before we go down to play stories, I want to have each of you gentlemen, starting with Tony. Each of you wrote a obituary this week. So Tony Semerad, you wrote about former Congressman Chris Cannon. Maybe just give me a minute on Congressman Cannon.
Yeah, he longtime congressman from the third district, I want to say, passed away on Wednesday, was one of the 13 House managers in the impeachment of Bill Clinton, a businessman, lawyer turned congressman, was remembered very fondly by his friends and political colleagues. And I think Robert knew him a little bit better than I did. But just kind of a fascinating figure in our political history.
Robert, anything you'd like to say about Chris Cannon?
Sure. I mean, as a cub reporter, brand new, I was one of the first elections I covered was Chris Cannon's bid, and he was always good to me as a young reporter, and I got to know him a little bit better when I was out in Washington, D.C. He was also kind of a lead appointment, I guess, on the George Bush immigration reform proposal, which cost him politically, I think, to try to find some sort of middle ground on that contentious issue back in the early 2000s. But it was something that he felt strongly about. So yeah, he was interesting because after he left politics, he kind of disappeared from the public spotlight, I think, to a large extent. So but yeah, Chris is going to be missed by many of his friends in the Republican political world.
Then Robert, you had an obituary on former Utah lawmaker and marathoner Richard Carling. Give me your short version of that.
Yeah, Richard was a longtime state legislator. He's an attorney. Spent 23 years in the House and the Senate up on Capitol Hill. When he was 39, he had this health scare. He thought he was having a heart attack, and the doctors said, "Well, you need to get more exercise." And he definitely did that. He went on over the next 4+ decades to run over 175 marathons. He ran St. George 45 times. Boston, I think, was close to 40. Just going, going, going. But yeah, he passed away recently at the age of 84. Set well, he not records, but he was definitely one of the elite marathoners in terms of the prolific number of races that he had run. So yeah, Richard Carling was again left a mark on the state, but also left a mark on marathoning.
Well, let's turn to our underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. Let's start with Jessica Miller. What's your underplayed story?
I want to pick a story that Courtney Tanner published today. It's about the commissioner who was overseeing higher education for Utah abruptly resigned last fall. And I know she's been working since that happened to figure out why. She's got a little bit of an answer now. He was under investigation for alleged misconduct. So yeah, I think it's a really important story. And she's been doing a lot of work to try to get these records to shed more light on what was happening.
Yeah, check that out at sltrib.com. Julie Jagg had to jump off the call here. She's following up on that avalanche story. But she did tell me that she's putting forward Blake Apgar's story that Salt Lake City Little Leaguers, when we talked on this program with Blake about this, the field rents were just becoming prohibitive, and some of those leagues are maybe going to have to disband or raise rates prohibitively. Now, some good news. Field rental rates might be lowered. The city council is expected to lower those field rental rates for youth sports leagues. So some good news, and that was put forward by Julie Jagg. Tony Semerad, what's your underplayed story?
I am going to recommend a wonderful piece by my colleague Sophia Jeremias about populations of American white pelicans returning this year to Gunnison Island and Hat Island in the north arm of the Great Salt Lake. This has surprised biologists. With the dropping of the lake, there have been land bridges created that let predators get to these islands when they were once isolated, not ideal for breeding new pelicans, but they have now returned to Hat Island this year, and biologists are watching this closely.
All right. SLTrib.com for that one.
SLTrib.com for that one.
Robert Gerke, what's your underplayed story?
Oh, it sounds like we're getting some feedback there.
Yeah, I think we got that fixed.
Yeah, I would also recommend checking out Courtney's story, the one Jessica mentioned. But Emily Anderson Stern did a piece about the state auditor who they launched this website to take complaints about the new transgender bathroom bill. You know, the portal was set up basically so people who were concerned about whether, you know, there were people using the bathroom that was not of their birth could register those with the state auditor. In the first 24 hours, it got 4,000 complaints. It's received over 10,000 now. But the auditor issued a statement, a pretty scathing statement, pointing the finger at the legislature saying, hey, look, if you don't like the bill, don't bombard my office. Go, you know, take your complaints to the legislature. He said he never wanted to be the bathroom monitor. He said the legislature is intrusive and overly invasive. And, you know, he said he's not going to look into allegations that, you know, that it would invade somebody's privacy about what gender they are, what bathroom they're using. That's not his job. So it was a pretty, you know, eye-popping statement from a Republican auditor directed at the Republican legislature who had saddled him with this burden that he never really wanted to be a part of. So it's interesting, worth looking at sltrib.com.
SLTrib.com, yeah, for sure. I like that line. He didn't sign up to be the bathroom monitor. I'll mention a story from Mark Eddington in Southern Utah. Just a very disturbing pictures here in a story about vandals defacing a Southern Utah recreation hotspot near St. George. They're still looking for the culprits. And some of that they say will not be able to be removed from the stone. Just a very sad story. Check that out at sltrib.com. Well, you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We've been talking with investigative reporter Jessica Miller, and Olympics and Enterprise reporter Julie Jagg, real estate reporter Tony Semerad, and news columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks to them. Thanks to you for listening, and hope you'll join us next time for Behind the Headlines.